We are the space robots. We are here to protect you. Back, Chewie, us. Back, Chewie, us. Back, Chewie, us.
All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Pusher Robot.
And this is the Shover Robot.
And we are here to protect you
from the terrible secret of space.
And our terrible secret this week comes in the form of the brains in space, such as it is, which are computers.
HAL 9000. Everything is going exceptionally well.
It's actually kind of funny because, you know, it's so coincidental that I can't remember if it's a theory or a fact about the whole, like, you know, HAL and then IBM is just one letter offset, H to I, A to B, you know, L to M, so IBM versus HAL. And IBM is like the thing, you know, most of the computers that are in space, at least a lot of the early ones, because they were big into avionics manufacture back in the day. But
I never noticed that.
Spooky. That's awesome.
So the IBM 9000 is what we got to watch out for.
Yep. I don't think we're quite there yet, but we're getting there. So, computers in space. And the reason that we talk about this is, in modern space travel, computers are a huge part about how we operate in space, especially when it comes to complex space habitats or complex rocket maneuvers, and when we get, you know, eventually into maybe driving ships with nuclear warheads. You really don't want to just be eyeballing that kind of stuff. Or
especially on the latter.
Yeah, manually handling life support systems, that kind of deal. So computers are a huge deal when it comes to space travel. And space itself presents a variety of challenges for computer technology. Because the same thing that we've talked about before, cosmic radiation and a lack of atmosphere and that kind of deal, is actually really, really difficult to overcome when it comes to computer applications.
So it's just as difficult for computers to be in space as like for living things to be in space?
Yeah, for different reasons. So, I mean, computers won't necessarily die unprotected in space, but they won't work quite right. So computers in space, above anything else, they prioritize reliability above speed, because computers that are in the consumer electronics world obviously can run high-end video games at reasonable frame rates, but when you're in space, you're not really running a high-end video game at reasonable frame rates. You're just trying to keep the lights on and keep the air circulator running, which you don't need, you know, gigahertz to do that. That's easily in the realm of, like, a megahertz operation.
So, wait, you're telling me that I can't, like, bring a high-end gaming computer into space? Because that was totally my plan for a trip to Mars, is bring a high-end gaming computer. That way I don't lose my mind.
Well, you could.
On the way there.
You could, and we'll talk about that here in a second.
Excellent.
So, what was a big news story last year was the Orion space capsule that they went up and tested. Everybody was talking about how it used an IBM PowerPC 750X single-core processor, which was in vogue back in 2002. That's basically the processor that was the last major processor in the MacBook line before they switched over to Intel processors. So, a very bulky and slow processor compared to, you know, what was available in 2015. So why didn't they just use the latest, you know, Core i7 processor?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, why didn't they?
I don't know.
I'm honestly confused. No. So above and beyond, processors need to withstand two major things in space. The first thing is vibration. The next thing is radiation. And in order to just make everything completely sure, in space computer applications, usually you have more than one computer. Usually you have three or five computers, mostly three, because five gets a little complicated. But computers in space applications use what's called majority verification, and even some flight computers use this in terrestrial aviation, that kind of deal. And basically what the sense is that you have three computers. All three of them get the same input data and perform the same calculation at the same time. And then when they're done, they check their results with each other. And if two of them agree and one of them does not, then the two of them the answer that comes out is the one that was majority verified. If all three of them disagree, then they go back and they do the calculation again, or they use some kind of weighted gauge to see if, you know, if the calculation is critical, that it like needs to be there now, they just kind of have to roll with whatever one is seeming to be the most correct.
That sounds like ridiculously similar to my my college career in our mathematics classes, where we'd get together and we'd start working a problem, and then yeah
I think that's how all college math and physics courses work, is just three or four of us got this and two of us got this other thing, let's just go with the, you know.
But the shuttle actually, it had a three separate systems with one backup as well, so it had four total systems on board the shuttle, if I do remember correctly. I use that, the majority verification, pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, and usually they use three, just the same way that we have an odd number of Supreme Court justices, so that we don't have an equal number of results, like two say one thing and two say another thing. You always will have a majority on one side or the other, or they'll all be in disagreement, in which case the calculation is usually rerun. Because when it comes to space applications and you have like a computer calculating your trajectory for reentry into an atmosphere, you really don't want to be very wrong when it comes to, you know, aiming it at the appropriate angle of descent kind of deal, so you don't, you know, either bounce off the atmosphere or just burn up completely.
Kerbal Space Program.
All right, so vibration resistance is something that's pretty easy to take care of in computers. Basically, you just have more mounts around the processor. The processor is usually not quite so close together with everything. The components are either more spread out and reinforced, or they're compacted into smaller areas depending on your application. Basically, anything that removes the ability for them to kind of vibrate around on each other. And this also makes surface mount electronics quite a bit less useful in space applications, because surface mount boards are pretty easy to shake stuff loose from if you hit them at the right angle or with the right frequency of vibrations, versus through-hole boards, which, of course, you've got, you know, a crap ton of solder going through the board and sucking everything together. Solder.
Can you explain to me, not a whole lot of computer background, but a surface mount versus a through board?
So through-hole is what you used to see. That's basically, like, you've got your resistor, and it's the little resistive component, I don't know what to call it, and you've got the two big long pins off of it, and then you bend the pins and you stick them through the holes in the PCB, the printed circuit board.
Yeah, and then you solder them on the back?
Yeah, you solder them on the back.
Okay, I'm good. Familiar with that.
Surface mount is where you've just got like the little thing that's got pads on the bottom, and then the board is just, you know, it's flat and it's got two little pads. You put little drops of solder on that and put the chip on top of the pads, and it just sucks it to the, you know, you melt down the solder in a special solder oven, and it mounts it to the front. So surface mount is super compact because you can have components occupying the same space on the front and back of the board at the same time with relative ease. But through hole, you know, it has to go through the board all the way, so you lose that space over all the different layers of the PCB. So if you got like a 15-layer PCB, you just lost that amount of space over 15 layers that you could have used. So surface mount is like a huge space saver, but is more, it's affected more by heat and vibrations than through hole is, just because through hole's, you know, so bulky and has a lot of solder holding it together.
Yes, it does, indeed.
Yeah. So, vibrations are a big concern. By far and away, the biggest concern for computing ability is radiation. And not because it's going to, like, melt the processor or anything like that, but because when it comes to computer data, you're performing, in a modern processor, millions of operations every second. And each of those operations is being carried out using an incredibly minuscule electric charge, like microvolts of charge, because anything more than that and those millions of operations per second would amount to the processor basically turning into a small nuclear mushroom cloud because of all the heat coming off of it. So each calculation is a very, very small amount of energy, and that amount of energy, if struck with a decaying beta particle or a gamma radiation, you know, they're not particles, but a unit of gamma radiation is enough to make that very, very small state change. So you could, it's like the difference between flipping a 0 to a 1 mid-calculation or in a section of flash memory, you know, having a single bit or a couple bits flipped. And that is a really big problem because you're corrupting data in that case. And that's why we have this three-factor verification, because if one processor gets hit in the right way with a small particle of cosmic energy, then it'll flip a bit, it'll corrupt its data, the calculation will come out wrong, and the other two processors will come in and be like, yo, dude, you screwed up. Because radiation.
Radiation. I like that term, flip a bit.
Flip a bit.
Just like, I'm going to have to like work that in my speech sometime. Like, man, I was so angry, I just flipped a bit.
I flipped a bit. So this doesn't happen on Earth, of course, because cosmic radiation is shielded out by the atmosphere quite a bit. But as soon as you get outside of the protective sphere of our atmosphere, you're getting pelted with cosmic radiation all the time. And in some cases, you can severely corrupt data just because of how much you're getting bombarded with it. So there's a couple of ways that we combat this. One of them is a reason why we use older processors, and especially older technology. Like, you still see in some space applications, especially like the older space shuttles and that kind of jazz, they use, you know, vacuum tube setups and high power like analog equipment rather than digital equipment. And the reason for that is because as you increase the power, like those old processors, of course, they used a lot more power. So each of the calculations, not only did they happen slower, but they happened at quite a bit higher power threshold. The additional energy input by a cosmic particle isn't enough to really do anything. It doesn't have much of an effect on the data being operated on. So it's much more secure in that sense. And today we do a process where we called rad harding, or radiation harding, but hardening, but I like rad harding better because it sounds cooler.
It does.
So you rad hard your chips, you rad hard your ICs and your circuit boards in general. And what that does is that adds a protective layer of shielding over the chip to make sure that it drives away most of the radiation. And then it also has the processor clocked down to run slower, and it also runs at a higher power level than it did before. So your trade-off basically is that your data is more secure from being interfered with by cosmic radiation because it's slower, so the minute interruptions from a cosmic radiation strike on the processor is diminished in its effect. And since it's using more power, that effect is further diminished. But of course, you know, now your chip that normally ran at like 10 watts, and it's a stupid figure, but we'll just go with it for the sake of example. Like, a chip that ran at 10 watts and 100 megahertz now runs at 10 megahertz and like 15 watts. So you're drawing a lot more power and not getting as much process out of it, but darned if it's not getting screwed with by cosmic radiation.
Right. Okay.
So we've seen that they have, you know, from all the information about the ISS, like, they've got their laptops sent up there, and they can, you know, use them like regular laptops. And that's because those ones have been rad hardened to a degree, since they're not mission critical in most cases. Because a lot of the times, you know, the personal laptops obviously are not quite as mission critical. And the ISS is also pretty low down, you know, in our atmosphere compared to an interstellar spacecraft or even a craft heading towards the moon would be, which would need a lot more rad hardening. So they can still use modern electronics. They just have to have this special protective layer on them and have to have some certain tweaks done to them just to make them function, you know, more like a regular computer. So getting back to you wanting to play games on Mars, you could totally do that. You just would need to have a very hot rig to do it, and it'd need to be pretty hardcore rad hard.
Hardcore rad hard computer. Now, does that and I'm assuming that like a solar storm, the radiation from that's going to also affect just the higher energy particles like protons and such and electrons. That's going to affect this stuff the same as interstellar radiation. I mean, it's kind of the same thing, but obviously coming from the sun, it's a lot closer, and I would just assume that that is something that we got to watch out for.
Yeah.
And that, because that'll wipe out your computers and stuff, or not computers, but satellites, because if I remember right, they have a watch system set up right now that if they detect some certain amount of solar activity or a flare goes off or a CME, they will actually try to adjust satellites' orbits so that they are in a more shielded area during the time that the cloud of solar particles is going to come through the area.
Yeah. And, I mean, a thing like a solar flare is going to hose computers because it's basically an EMP in its effect. It's just a lot of... It's a highly charged field that, when it interacts with a circuit, is going to produce charges all across the circuit in places that there weren't supposed to be charges, and it'll just, you know, fry it in most cases. And, you know, even on Earth, we're not protected from that. A good solar flare aimed right at the Earth, and we've had several in the last year, couple of years or so, that we missed out on barely, but still cause like radio interference and stuff. If we get a good solar flare right at the Earth, we're liable to lose power in America for a couple of weeks at the worst, because it'll vaporize our archaic power distribution grid.
Yeah, our grid sucks.
Yeah.
In fact, this just reminded me, oh gosh, it was right at the turn of the 19th century or 20th century. So like the early 1900s, there was a solar flare that we had like just, no kidding, gone to like electric lights, and some major cities had it. Not everybody had it. It was just like the time that it was the cool new thing, and like all of them went out. There was some sort of solar activity, and they just like completely took out the fledgling electric grid. Like it was nothing. But yeah. If we got hit by something like that today, we'd be so freaking screwed.
Yeah, I mean, if that were to occur, the nicest effect that could happen if it was a low-grade one is just all of our fuses would pop, because there would be a large charge that would build up, in some cases in the wrong direction, in some cases in the right direction, but it would overvolt or overcurrent, depending on your point of view, a particular system. And all the fuses would pop, and we just have to replace them all. That would be the easiest one. The hardest one would be if we got a really bad one and it produced charges that were great enough to cause lines to burn out and certain components to burn out, you know, just have transformers all over the place just explode, which is what happens in an overcurrent situation if it's bad enough. So you could potentially see, you know, lots of fires at power distribution centers. So in space, that stuff is a lot easier to come across because we don't have as much shielding. So having that kind of application or that kind of shielding around is super important, because you don't want your electronics to just fry.
No, absolutely not. And I'm gonna go quick real back and just to kind of close the loop on that, as I looked it up. So it wasn't the turn of the 19th or the turn of the 20th century like I thought it was. This was actually between August 28th and September 2nd of 1859. It was called the Carrington Super Flare. Mm-hmm. And like most notably, you could see if people in the northeastern United States could read the newspaper by the aurora boreal, the aurora's light, and like, no kidding, all of the telegraph operators were getting, like, shocks, and, like, telegraph systems were, like, lighting on fire because of the flux from this thing.
Yeah, like, it's a super big deal, both on a terrestrial scale and in a space scale, of the effects of solar flares and such, because we're in the habitable zone of our star, but we are not out of danger by any means from certain events like that occurring. Fortunately, a solar flare impacting the atmosphere is generally not fatal to biological life, but it sure as heck does play hell with any kind of electric grid, especially long electric lines, because the longer the line, the more space you have to induct the flux coming down from the solar flare, and stuff just goes south pretty quickly. So yeah.
Indeed.
And when you're on a spacecraft, the most important thing is, of course, the life support system. So that's why they generally don't use computers, like newer computers and life support system. Usually a lot of that can be handled with analog circuitry versus digital circuitry. So it's a lot more stable and safer to just leave it to that, because it is a lot harder to foul up. But yeah. So, a couple other things about computers that are interesting in space. Digital, or when it comes to memory storage, or non-volatile storage, excuse me, the spin disk hard drives are definitely out. It either has to be magnetic tape, or it has to be the new flash hard drives, which are becoming increasingly popular and, of course, much more stable for these kinds of applications. The reason that spin disk hard drives are out is because they don't even work very well above 8,000 to 10,000 feet in Earth's atmosphere, simply because they've been machine precisioned. That's not the right word at all.
Precision machined.
That's an order. Precision machined so well that they rely to some extent on the air pressure of the surrounding atmosphere to keep the needle above the hard disk platter during a spin operation. And so if you get above a certain altitude, that air pressure is not there anymore, so it has a chance to, you know, if you have a vibration, it'll just dip over and just scoop a section of your non-vol off of the hard disk platter and just hose it over real hardcore. So you definitely could not use those very effectively in a space application because you have no air pressure and a lot of vibration. So hard disks are kind of out.
You like driving an old car listening to a CD.
Yeah.
Just skip, skip, skip.
Yeah, basically. So the last major thing that it would improve if we got a little bit, you know, better computers, and we're always getting them better all the time and finding new ways to get around this radiation problem, is satellite communication is currently affected severely by this limitation. And it's mostly because of the processing speed that is required to send transmissions is why it takes so long to send and receive transmissions from our satellites that are currently on their way out of the solar system, like the Voyager ones and New Horizons and that kind of jazz. Because on their computers, they wanted to, you know, of course, make sure that they worked a lot because, you know, once you send it out there, it's not going to be very practical to go and repair it if something goes wrong. So in order to preserve the CPU and preserve the integrity of the data as much as you can, you just clock down the CPU way down to something in probably the kilohertz range, although I haven't seen the specs on the New Horizon probe to see what it was running at. But at communication rates that low, it takes a long time to send data versus, you know, anything that's like a chip-to-chip thing on a smartphone or any modern PCB. So each of the transmitting, like each byte, takes quite a while to get through. Yeah. Hmm. Data's weird.
Data's strange. Yeah, that's really interesting too, because I mean, not only with those, dear goodness, the spacecraft way out there in the dark, so far away, not only are they being exposed to more of a hostile environment because they're, you know, a Voyager especially because it went through the heliopause, I think is what it's called, the shockwave of the sun that basically is another shield for stuff coming in from way deep space.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do they have to contend with that, but, I mean, the conditions out there are a little bit more dicey. The temperature definitely a lot less, I believe,
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous. In
dangerous.
Space. Now, my quick question is, do you see a future in space for quantum computing and or fiber optic computing?
Oh, dear God. Well, okay, so fiber optic is kind of an auto yes, just because of the way that it operates. Because fiber optic is different from traditional cabling. Traditional cabling, usually we run on coax cabling for a lot of communications because it's just a twisted pair, which preserves the transmission from outside interference better than straight cabling. But in regular coaxial cabling, you've got, you know, transmission going along in the sense that you have electrical pulses. It's either like a differential signal, like one cable above at a voltage above another cable is a 1, whereas if they're, you know, reversed, it's a 0, or you have legitimate data pulses being transmitted along the cable in high-low voltage on a single line. And that, of course, can be interfered with a large amount of ambient electric interference, like a solar flare. But fiber optics is just a really, really nice glass tube with some opaque edges that when you shine light in one end, light comes out the other end. So in that sense, they're super, super stable for transmitting data along a large stretch of possible interference, because, you know, it doesn't matter how much electricity you've got flowing around that glass tube. It's, it don't care. As long as there's no light trying to get into the tube from another point, which usually, you know, there's not, because it's opaqued on the sides to preserve the light refraction down the tube. So fiber optics is going to be super useful in future space applications, because all you have to worry about is shielding the transceivers on either end that are handling the light pulses, and in between, you know, it's pretty much fair game. Nice. Quantum computing is still so out there that it's going to be difficult to see where that one's going to work. There's still not a lot of advantage in using quantum computing over regular computing for space applications thus far, because quantum computing is, of course, really, really good at solving complex math problems, usually single math problems, because right now they're working on factoring large numbers, large multiples of large primes, which is the
Optimus
basis of,
Prime.
Yeah, the basis of RSA encryption, which I semi-sincerely hope they never get it to work, because that jumps over P equals NP, and that gets into a weird area of everybody's bank account disappears overnight if they actually figure out how to do that and it gets into the wrong hands.
Oh, gosh.
So that's a different story, though. That's not space-related. That's world of finance-related. But
soon to be the terrible secret of world finance, yeah. Our next podcast series.
Basically. So quantum computing right now is really difficult because you need to have really, really cold temperatures to handle the incredible heat being put off by the quantum processor. And it may be easier to do that in space because you have access to a large amount of cold, or rather of not warm, I guess is probably the best way to put that, area. Yeah. Even though, you know, a vacuum is the ultimate insulator because there's nothing to give off the heat to. But in a sense, experimenting in space might be a little bit easier than trying to create a near absolute zero environment on the ground to experiment in these days, like we have with the D-Wave 2, like, truck of a processor or of a computer stack is what it looks like at this point.
But, yeah, absolutely. And you also have got the... A lot of the propulsion and life support systems run off cryogenics, so
yeah.
You might be able to tap into a pre-existing system with that. Maybe.
Yeah, as far as practical applications, it's... Unless you're doing some kind of advanced simulation stuff in space where you'd need really, really detailed calculations in a really, really short time frame, I don't think that you would need a quantum computer to do those calculations for you, because they're just in such a different direction than what we currently have as our computer architectures, because they're weird. They perform all the calculations at once and then arrive at the correct one at the same time as they arrive at all the wrong ones, which is going to be difficult to design a system that can avoid race conditions around, probably, if you're doing like a multi-threaded application. But it's kind of the way that it goes.
And that's not technobabble, folks. If you know computers, you know what he's talking about. But if you're like me, that just went right over your head.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't know. There's going to be at least one person that's like, you're totally wrong. And I'll be like, yeah, I probably am. So it's okay. It's a work in progress.
Indeed.
But yeah, computers in space. They're complicated. They are important. And they are usually pretty rad hard. That's what you need to know.
Absolutely. And we've been, just a quick history, if I do remember correctly, the first ones that we were really using back in the day was Gemini. The Gemini capsules actually had computers. And then from that's where it started, and, you know, obviously we still use them today. And this probably would have been better at the beginning, but it's okay. super useful on the ground for ground control and doing any sort of astrodynamic equations. If you saw the movie The Martian, the Ritz per null maneuver, yeah, was an incredibly detailed, or would have been if it was real, a really detailed astrodynamic calculation, which without computers would take probably, probably wouldn't be able to do by hand in any lifespan.
Like, as it stands right now, the bulk of space computing is more a factor of there's a computer on the ship that all it does is receive the ground telemetry and then does a thing. And then the computers on the ground are the big, fast, and mean ones that can tear through all of this data. And then it just sends the results of that calculation to the computers up in space and they just do it. So not going to be the way that it's going to happen for a potential interplanetary mission, because 11 light minutes away is not going to be a very solid way to communicate to a satellite. I mean, it's good enough for like the Spirit rovers and Opportunity and Curiosity and that kind of jazz, because they're not trying to keep people alive. But
yeah, even Curiosity, though, with their whole crazy re-entry with the sky crane, that was right on the cusp of the edge of what we could really do with distance computing.
Yeah,
I want to say,
I mean, once you hit the you can't transmit faster than the speed of light, at least not that we know of at the moment, unless they get that whole
entanglement
thing worked out. But, and if that happens, that's pretty wicked. But if you can't transmit faster than the speed of light, then we're going to have to move in a direction where you have more advanced computers that are more capable being contained in a way that they're not affected by the conditions in space. And that's going to be a huge challenge that I'll be interested to see how they solve it, or interested to help solve it if that's where my life goes. That'd be nice too.
That sure would.
But yeah, that's computers in space, folks. Stay in school.
Stay in school, and you too can understand what just was explained.
Yeah, what this last 30 minutes was about.
If that sounded exciting to you, you might want to pursue a career in computer engineering.
Pretty much. Got several colleges. All right. Well, that's about all for this evening, folks. So until next time, I am the Pusher Robot.
And I'm the Shover Robot.
And you have gone
down the stairs.
I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space.